This is the Angry GM, and this is a proofread aloud again, the final proofread aloud of the month. And, you know, I'm still a bit under the weather, so I know these proofread alouds aren't up to my usual quality, and I apologize, but, you know, I'm soldiering through nonetheless. So here we go with a proofread aloud entitled Ask Angry August 2023 Mailbag. And I do apologize for leaning a little heavily into the Ask Angry and Bullshit columns right now. It's really helping me get back on track and to recover a bit. So, you know, it's content that is a little bit easier to produce, but where I still feel that I can put out quality content, because quality is always something that I'm striving for. I never want to put out something that I think is crap. Anyway, enough that. Let me just start this. So, Ask Angry August 2023 Mailbag. To close out this extremely difficult month, I'm popping open the old Angry Mailbag and answering a handful of your questions. Want to submit a question for a future Ask Angry column? Send it to ask.angry@angry.games. Want me to actually answer your question? Then keep it short and get to the friggin' point. And for crap's sake, tell me clearly and explicitly what to call you. Alan asks, is there any way to get the players to accept their characters being captured? In my experience, they will always fight to the death in a losing battle and TPK before surrendering, no matter how mild the consequences might be. If I introduce a scenario where the players start already captives, such as a slave revolt, jailbreak, rescue, or mission in exchange for their freedom, players will simply walk away and refuse to play. Thanks, Alan, for the clear, concise question and the explicit permission to call you Alan. Thanks also for the nice, normal, easy-to-type name. You're lucky this ain't a perfect world, otherwise I wouldn't have to slather you with gratitude for following such simple instructions. I don't get how there are so many role-playing gamers with such piss-poor reading comprehension skills. Oh, right, none of you read the fucking rule books either. Oh, I'm sorry, that's not an F word. That's not an F-bomb, actually. Oh, right, none of you read the friggin' rule books either. I guess I'm not special. Anyway, this is where my barely earned friendly politeness ends and the crapping on your parade starts, because the answer to your question is a big, fat no. As in no, there isn't any way to get your piss baby brats to accept being captured. I need to emphasize your hard. It needs bold italics. No, there isn't any way to get your piss baby brats to accept being captured. And I ain't saying that because they fight every fight to the death. Most player characters live and die by the Captain Taggart rule. Never give up, never surrender. But you can get around that. What you can't get around is a group of players who will literally quit the game rather than play the scenario you're presenting. See, I'm taking what you said at face value here. I know you wouldn't make an ass of yourself by assuming that to be the case or overstating it. So if what you said is true, there's nothing you can do. You're running a game for a bunch of spoiled brats who didn't get the spankings they desperately needed as kids, and they're beyond your help. My advice is, get out. This isn't hyperbole. I mean what I'm saying. I would absolutely never, ever run any sort of game for players who'd walk away from the table rather than giving my scenario a chance, no matter how skeptical they were. Within reason, obviously. If I were doing something gory or sexual or heavy, and a player said to me, with respect and politeness, hey, I'm not comfortable with this, I can't participate. That's a different story. But a classic captured by slavers, break out, then break them scenario? Sorry, that's the game, bucko. Don't let the door hit you where the good Lord split you. I'm addressing this because I hear this shit a lot from game masters these days. Everyone's terrified their players will up and walk away if they don't like the game. I love running games, but I don't need it so bad that a bunch of spoiled players can bully me by threatening to withhold their participation. That isn't a healthy gaming dynamic. And the moment you give in, you stop being a game master and start being a puppet made to dance by a committee of self-serving brats. A word which I'm repeating deliberately, by the way, because brat is the right word for it. These are toddlers throwing tantrums to get their way. And every time you give in, you teach the babies that their tantrums work. And before you ask, this advice holds across all possible gaming situations. And lest you think I don't put my money where my mouth is, let me tell you something about how I run this patron-supported site and community. There have been times when people have objected to things I've said, jokes I've made, and opinions I've espoused. I know that's shocking to consider given how lovable and even-tempered and non-controversial I am, but it's true. And I've received emails from supporters that go something like this. Angry? I like your work, and I've been supporting you with my money for a long time, but you said this thing that got my panties in a bind, and if you say things like that again, I'm going to consider withdrawing my support. And I have responded every single time by sending the dumbass a full refund for 1 month's worth of support and blocking their ass on my support patron platforms. So that should answer all those, what if I'm a paid GM and my players threaten to stop paying me questions? It's weird to think of game mastering as a relationship, but it is. And this sort of run the game I demand or I'm going home bullshit represents a toxic, abusive relationship. My advice, therefore, is to run the scenario you want to run and let your players walk. If they walk. If all they do is grumble and whine and moan and resist, that's okay. Don't let up. Say, this is the game, play it or don't. They'll spend this first session fighting it, but players can't resist a good game for long. Just run the game and have a good time and they'll soften. This is actually a technique called getting the garden to weed itself, by the way. It's a very useful way to get undesirable, toxic elements in any community to remove themselves so you're left with a happy, healthy, thriving garden everyone can enjoy. I recommend it highly. Of course, you might discover that you were wrong all along, and by calling your players bluffs, you'll end up with a much healthier gaming relationship that makes all of you, players included, much happier. Or you'll have a lot more free time to pursue some other hobby. I'd call that a win-win. Sip. Alex asks, oop, I swallowed wrong. Oh God, it's a disaster. Alex asks, music is a super valuable part of video games, but I have trouble getting it to feel right at the table. Is there a best practice, or do you think it's just not worth it? Holy crap on a cream cracker, another person who can follow basic instructions. If this keeps up, y'all might restore my faith in humanity and drag me from the depths of my crippling depression. Not that I'm getting my hopes up. Anyway, music is a very important part of the video game experience, and also the TV and movie experiences. Music is a very powerful tool. It allows you to set a mood or tone without uttering a single word. As such, it's very attractive to game masters. Now, lots of you think I'm staunchly against using music at the table, and that's because in the past I've made some critical remarks about it and the game masters who use it. Remarks like, if you use music at your table, you should be dragged from behind your screen and bludgeoned to death with your Bluetooth speaker bar. I get how some of you might misinterpret that as my being totally against music at the game table. I'm not. I'm just against game masters using it badly, which they inevitably do, because they refuse to accept the limitations of their medium. First, game masters need to remember that movies have a thing called sound mixing, and video games have separate volume sliders for voice, sound effects, ambience, and background music. Do you know why? Because music makes it harder to hear everything else. And that's especially true when you're doing anything via voice chat online. Lots of people have trouble pulling voices from background noise in real life. Electronic communication drastically reduces audio quality and fidelity. And the quality of internet communication can vary wildly from moment to moment. All it takes is a bee farting next to a fiber optic cable in Dubuque, and whole sentences are lost to the ether. Video quality is similarly iffy, and similarly prone to bee fart-related pixel dropping and desynchronization, which means people can't reliably fall back on reading lips to supplement their listening skills, which is something every human being does, even the ones who can't read lips. That's one of the major reasons why you can understand speech better if you can see the speaker's face. The point is, if you're not prepared to invest in a seriously good auto-ducking setup, that's where the software you're using automatically reduces or mutes one audio channel to give another priority, or use a setup where everyone can adjust the voice to music volumes on their own ends, you are not allowed to use music in your online games. You just can't. Don't. As a game master, clear and effective communication is your highest priority. Anything that affects that even a tiny little bit is doing more harm than good. As a game master, pacing is also a very high priority. Nothing affects the quality of your game as much as how you pace it, which, remember, isn't about keeping the game moving fast. Anything that hurts the pace of the game is of dubious benefit, to say the least. Pacing trumps mood. Orchestras don't have to play movie soundtracks as the movie's being filmed, and the movie director doesn't have to conduct the orchestra at the same time. And video games with dynamic soundtracks can manage that feat because a computer can do thousands of different things every nanosecond. But if you, a game master, want to switch the music to a different track every time a combat starts, you've got to fiddle with your music thingy. Even if you plan your session super accurately and build an ordered playlist such that all you have to do is play tracks on a loop and hit one single button to advance the track when the players get to the dungeon, that's still a pace breaker unless you can literally reach over and hit the button on your music thingy without pausing your narration or breaking eye contact. So unless you're willing to set those things up well in advance and practice your mad DJ skills with a Z to the point where it doesn't say in the article with a Z, but that's, you know, I guess that's closed captioning for people who are listening to this via audio only, is just so you know, the humor element in that line is I use the street Z in skills because I'm very street. As you know, I am well-versed in the ghetto tongue. So, unless you're willing to set things up well in advance and practice your mad DJ skills to the point where you can do that, where you can do just that effortlessly, damn it. So, unless you're willing to set things, I'm well-versed in the ghetto tongue. I can't get through the sentence because the Z in skills is throwing me off. Especially because I insist on pronouncing it. I have noticed that if I have a deliberate misspelling and it's got the red squiggly doos underneath it, as they do, then it throws me off. First of all, I have to pronounce it to emphasize the misspelling. I can't not do it. I do it automatically. And second of all, it's kind of like hitting a speed bump in the sentence and then my eyes will like careen out of control. Fun fact. So unless you're willing to set things up well in advance and practice your mad DJ skills to the point where you can do just that effortlessly, you might want to give up on the idea of dynamic music. None of that's to say you can't use music. See, music's a nice tool for ambient mood setting, not just because of its effectiveness, but also because of how easily it's ignored or overridden by the action at the table. And because it's okay to let the tone of an entire work bleed into every scene. What does that mean? Consider how every movie has lighter moments and darker moments. Even horror and suspense movies have low tension or even comedic scenes. In those scenes, the musical score doesn't suddenly become a cartoon soundtrack. It just lightens up or backs off or takes on a slightly less dark vibe. The scores to Jaws and Saw and The Conjuring always sound like the scores to Jaws and Saw and The Conjuring. The point is, you can pick a tone for an entire session, find a few hours of music that fit that tone, and just let it go in the background to underscore the game. And that's the ideal way to use music. Fire and forget, or playlist and forget, or loop and forget. And if game masters would just be happy and leave well enough alone, that'd be fine. I would just leave it there. That's all I need to say. I don't know why I made that sentence complicated. And if game masters would just do that and leave it there, that'd be fine. Hell, if you have two or three major scenes in a session, town, wilderness, and dungeon, say, it's cool to have a playlist or score for each and switch the score during the transitions. The key is to do it quickly and subtly without drawing attention to it. Switching major scenes in a tabletop role-playing game often involves some note shuffling and map changing anyway, and lots of GMs necessarily have to pause the action at those transitions, which makes a good place for potty breaks, so you can just add score switching to those unavoidable loading screens. Hell, that whole loading screen issue's just another strength of my scene as structure approach to scenario design that so many of you dumbasses keep fighting me on. Background music is like makeup. It works best when no one notices it's there. It works best when no one notices that it's there. I needed that in there. Yeah. It's clumsy otherwise. Background music is like makeup. It works best when no one notices that it's there. This brings me to one last important issue, that of music choice. There's some shit you must consider when picking music for your game. First, people's brains get sucked into recall and identify mode very easily. If you use a track from a well-known movie or game, you run the risk that someone's brain will suddenly notice the music and say, hey, wait, is that, okay, it's a Sonic game, not Sonic 3. Wait, this part. Okay. Mystic Cave Zone, that's it. Crap, did I just yell that out loud? Whose turn is it, guys? The same is true of any music with lyrics. Humans can't hear language without trying to comprehend it. Second, music can jar people right out of the game. Certain styles of music will always throw some people off. Lots of people can't take electronic music, aka chiptunes, which lots of game masters love to throw into their games. And anachronistic or inappropriate for the genre music can break people's suspension of disbelief. That's why so many movies and games go for orchestral-type music. Most audiences find it pretty timeless, it's very versatile, and it rarely jars people out of the action. Anyway, that's probably way more than you expected me to say about music and games, which, frankly, is the problem. Because using music well is deceptively tricky. There's a lot to be aware of, and therefore there's a lot of work involved in doing it well. This means you also have to consider the question of whether there's a better way to spend your prep time. And that's why, even though I do get using music right at the table, I seldom do. Tyler asks, what is a beer and pretzels game, and how does it differ from regular play? First, I confess that all three of today's questioners followed the rules because I was specifically trolling the mailbag for questions that were easy to parse. Second, I also confess I was looking for some lighter, easier questions to tackle given my current mindset. That's why I started with that nice, light look into toxic relationships with spoiled brats. In short, I was up for some beer and pretzels content, and this question fits that bill perfectly. In tabletop gaming, board gamers, war gamers, and role-playing gamers alike use the term, In tabletop gaming, a beer and pretzels game. Yeah. I forgot the word game in there. A beer and pretzels game is a casual play experience. You're not meant to take it too seriously, and it ain't meant to tax you. You invite some buddies over for an afternoon, put some beers in the fridge, throw a bag of pretzels on the table, and have some casual, snacky, gamey buddy fun. It's as simple as that. As I always do, I tried to pin down the origin of the term, just so I'd have something interesting to share, but I didn't turn up anything I didn't already know, and that's that the term came into usage decades ago in the Midwestern wargaming community from which sprung the role-playing game hobby. Given that I now live in the heartland from whence sprung that community, I've come to understand the vital importance of beer and pretzels as part of all social events, so that tracks. I also discovered that the Three Stooges made a short film in 1933 called Beer and Pretzels, but it's got no connection to the modern gaming term, so that was a dead end, though I always enjoy an excuse to spend 20 minutes watching old slapstick comedies. In the role-playing gaming community, the term beer and pretzels refers less to any specific game system and more to the attitude of the participants. And while it's often associated with silly random jokiness, and while that often does find its way into such games, irreverence isn't actually a requisite. Hell, a beer and pretzels game can describe nothing more than a kick in the door, kick monster ass, and grab the loot with nary a concern for role-playing in character style of hack and slashy dungeon crawling fun. The key is the player's levels of emotional investment and cognitive load. If you want to put it in more game design-y terms, a beer and pretzels game is high in abnegation, or submission. It does not need you to turn your brain burner up too high. In the board and wargaming communities, there's games specifically classed as beer and pretzels games. They tend to be light on rules and complex strategic play, and they're usually quick to set up and break down. And because those communities are full of gamers, there are countless arguments about what exactly counts as a beer and pretzels game and how to draw clear, distinct, bright lines around them. Because whatever the community, gamers can't help but have objective fights over subjective qualities. In short, gamers are idiots. Really, that's the whole answer. Beer and pretzels games are casual gaming experiences you can fully enjoy even after you've put a few beers in you. But I'd be remiss if I didn't mention a personal favorite tabletop role-playing game that not only specifically calls itself a beer and pretzels game, but even calls its core system the Beer Engine. Its four stats are brawn, ego, extraneous, and reflexes, you see. The game's called Kobolds Ate My Baby, and it's a fucking delight. Remember how I said irreverent silliness ain't a requisite for beer and pretzels play? Well, forget that shit. Kobolds Ate My Baby leans hard on wackiness. In fact, I recommend reading it even if you never run it, because the rulebook is entertaining as hell from cover to orange-colored cover. If you need a good laugh, pick it up. And who doesn't need a good laugh these days? And that is the article and the proofread aloud, and I will be back next week with another. See ya.